some jumping jacks or burpees or something like that. We're having a little technical difficulties, so I'm going to have to go old school and manually advance. But that is me. I'm Rob. I work for a company called Dimatize in Dallas, Texas. I'm chief science officer. I'm a fellow of the ISSN, which is the reason why I'm here today, International Society of Sport and Nutrition. I'm an advisory board. I also on the editorial board for the Journal of the International Society of Sport and Nutrition, adjunct researcher at Kansas State University and author of a few books. My topic is nutrient timing, which is, it's certainly one of the most fun topics that I get to talk about. We certainly see a lot of it in the press. There's several books that have been written on nutrient timing. What do you think when you hear of nutrient timing? What's the first thing that comes to mind? Pre-workout? Post-workout. Yeah, so, and that's an obvious place to go. So let's kind of start with a definition, and then we'll go back to, what people think and how our thought process of nutrient timing has evolved over the last few decades. So one definition of nutrient timing could be the nutrition strategy in which specific amounts of nutrients are delivered at specific times in order to enhance performance or training effects. So that's, a simple definition, application of key nutrients at key times to maximize benefits of training. But if we go a little bit deeper, it's really kind of a complex topic, and it's great for conversation and great for debate, how important it is, which nutrients are most important, which nutrients aren't that important, whether or not we need to split some nutrients. So let's just kind of go a little bit deeper. It could be nutrition before, during, and immediately after exercise, which some of you kind of alluded to. But you got to remember that a day is 24 hours. So even if you go in and train for 2.4 hours, which most of us don't do, that's only one-tenth of the day. What about the other 90% of the day? How important is nutrition and key nutrients? So nutrition hours after exercise. A lot of times we leave the gym, we knock down some protein, maybe a couple of other things, and then we forget about it. Maybe we don't. Nutrition before bed, a new area that some people have termed nocturnal nutrition. How important is nutrition right before bed? Can that help and assist in gains over time? Because a lot of things happen while we sleep. Muscle is broken down while we sleep. So the gains that were sort of stimulated during training and progressed throughout the day with good nutrition, you may actually start to kind of go backwards a little bit while you sleep, is the thinking. Nutrition first thing in the morning. Okay, how early should you start nourishing the body? And my good friend Dr. Darren Wilby back there will say you got to feed the machine. And he means feed it constantly. You constantly have to be fueling the muscle that you're training to maximize the benefits. Feed the machine. So a couple of additional considerations. What does it mean? It's calories, carbs, proteins, branched chain amino acids, leucine that you hear about, specialized fat, CLA, omega-3, creatine, beta-alanine, HMB, calcium-free acid, okay? Others, nutrients. Is it just one time a day, or should some of these nutrients be split up over the course of the day? It's a really interesting area of sport nutrition now, especially gram-dose supplements, okay? Fish oil. How many people take fish oil? How many people take more than 1 gram of omega-3s per day? Okay. Should you be splitting that at a couple of meals? How many people take beta-alanine? Okay. If you're probably splitting that over 3 to 4 doses a day, minimizing the effects of higher levels, more than a gram, giving you paresthesia. Okay. Same thing with creatine as well. Okay. Recommended levels, 5-6 grams a day for most men is just a good level, and, should we be splitting that over the course of the day as well? So these are all areas related to nutrient timing. So it is a much broader topic than just, protein after you train. So going back in time, how many people remember Mr. Peabody and Sherman? All right, good. There's a couple of us in the room. But if we go back to the 1970s, and we kind of go back and see where the mindset was back in the 1970s with regard to nutrient timing. How many people can remember the 1970s? OK, Okay? Really, we were only talking about what was happening during training, and a lot of it was endurance-based. That's what we were kind of talking about. The hours before really didn't matter, and the hours after really didn't matter back in the 1970s. Most of what we knew focused around Gatorade at the time, and they were doing a lot of fun research. And if you look at the formulation, it's just salty sugar water, and that's what we were recommending during running, cycling, whatever, to enhance performance, extend performance, and extend the volume of training. Okay, and that's where kind of things were back in the 1970s. Protein was just starting to pick up, but by and large, back then, really what we, you know, we were pushing was Gatorade, which you can get in a six-pack of cans back then as well. Anybody remember the cans of Gatorade? Yeah. Good stuff. So when you got to the 1990s, I heard the 90s, we began to look at things a little bit different. We knew at this point post-workout nutrition was really important, okay? The proper nourishment and the availability of nutrients to muscle after exercise training was key to really maximize muscle protein synthesis and minimize muscle protein breakdown after training. We also knew that is important for the regeneration of glycogen, which was utilized during training. So we really recognized that after training back in the 1990s, nutrition was critical. We were really beginning to dabble around with before. And at this point, really caffeine was a big consideration back then. Caffeine before exercise and even during exercise. So this is kind of where we were, where most of the attention was back in the 90s. I always like to look at muscle and fitness as sort of a time capsule for where bodies and outfits and whatnot were back at different time points. So that's what it looked like back in the 90s. That's what it looks like in the 2000s. But in the 2000s, boy, we're just looking at everything a little bit different. We know that what happens after is really matters. More and more science comes out, just validates that. What happens before can really matter as well. What happens earlier before training matters, and what happens after training several hours later matters as well. In fact, you can take that last matters and just connect it all the way around till you get to the morning, and all that may matter as well. That's where we are now, looking at sport nutrition on a 24-hour continuum, you know, to maximize gains from training, to maximize recovery, hasten recovery, to minimize soreness, and to maximize adaptation. So during, and post is where we were all kind of thinking there, you know, first things that come to mind, okay? Post was, quickly identified as the first thing that comes to mind. Pre is a huge area of sport nutrition now, okay? And for Europa, it makes up a very large percentage of your product sales. So the idea of pre, during, and post, an excellent example of this is what Gatorade launched a couple of years ago. So let's focus on pre-performance nutrition. This is the hours prior, sort of preparing and priming muscle in the human body before it trains. What should we be thinking? What are we looking to accomplish in the 60 minutes, in the 15 minutes before, in the 60 minutes before, and maybe the 3 to 4 hours before? How do we lead up to it to maximize training, to maximize the benefit? So we're looking to deliver energy, and that's energy for the blood that can be circulating to muscle at the onset of exercise and within muscle as well, maximizing muscle glycogen stores. We'll talk about the importance of muscle glycogen in just a second. Providing the building blocks for muscle protein synthesis, amino acids, okay? Delivering them, getting them circulated in higher levels so that right when exercise starts, They're there. They're knocking on the door, and we'll talk about that in just a second. Metabolic support, muscle buffering support, delivering nutrients that can potentially have a positive impact on muscle metabolics during training. And then where a lot of pre-workout is now, especially products that are taken within the hour prior, people want energy, they want focus, they want to dial in. So when we do surveys, the number one reason why people take pre-workouts, these concepts come to the top. They want to feel energized. They want to feel dialed in, intense during their workout. So these are all the things that you are targeted pre-workout. And again, So what you do prior to, the hours prior to, can help top off muscle glycogen stores. Muscle glycogen stores are incredibly important to maximize performance, especially if that performance is sustained over a long period of time. So we'll blend in both endurance information and resistance training information. We'll talk about how they may be a little bit different, but you know, some of these concepts carry across lines, as you'll see. For instance, submaximal cycling, just cycling, you know, at a good intensity prior to fatigue. How long can individuals go before they fatigue? A lot of this depends on what their muscle glycogen stores are prior to the onset. So you can see individuals that have about 3% of their muscle as glycogen can go out about 180 minutes, almost 3 hours, or right around 3 hours, versus all the way down at the bottom, somebody who has muscle glycogen stores that are 0.6% of their muscle mass. They're going to go about a third as long as somebody starting out with good stores. It's fuel in the tank. How much fuel do you have in the tank at the onset of exercise? A lot of times we focus heavily on protein, and we don't look heavily on carbohydrate, especially in resistance training. Maybe we should spend more time thinking about them in combination, doing different things, but always considering them together. Okay, so just some highlights, some notes on pre-exercise nutrition. Optimal carbohydrate and protein content in a pre-exercise meal is dependent upon what the optimal level is. It depends on a number of factors, including how long you're going to train, how intense, what your existing fitness level is, you know, what your training level is. But general guidelines fall into about 1 to 2 grams of carbohydrate per kilo and about 0.15 to 0.25 grams of protein. And that's about 3 to 4 hours prior to exercise. This is a good meal. If you're going to work out in the afternoon, maybe 3 to 4 hours before, this is a good nourishing meal that's going to, you know, help supply carbohydrate to top off muscle glycogen stores, help deliver protein and amino acids to muscle to make them available for muscle protein synthesis during that time, as well as during and depending on how long your exercise is, maybe a little bit after. Pre-exercise ingestion of essential amino acids or protein alone can increase post-exercise muscle protein synthesis. A lot of focus on post-exercise protein delivery, but the science and the research suggests that you can get the same benefit if you ingest protein immediately before a resistance training session. So, you know, at that point, it comes down to really a couple of things. When was your last meal prior? So if you had a good last meal, as in bullet A, you probably don't need protein immediately before. Okay, so if you're going to train for like an hour, then you can just target post. But if you haven't, if you wake up in the morning and it's your first, you know, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, you're going to train at 9, then you definitely have to have pre-exercise protein, okay, and carbohydrate. So it really comes down to lifestyle, when your last meal is. And then, you know, there's some extra questions that still need to be answered, especially with how long you're going to be training. I think an area that still is undefined is a lot of times people go into the gym and they'll train for several hours. They'll go in and they'll train for like 2 hours in the gym. They'll work one body part and then move on to another body part, or they'll work two and then move on to another two. What that means is post-exercise for one body part is actually starting while you're starting to train another. So if that's your workout regimen, then you probably want to give more focus to protein before you train, okay? It's not a well-explored area, but, you know, again, this comes, you know, back to the idea of individuality, customizing sport nutrition and nutrient timing to your training and your lifestyle and your day. All right. Light carbohydrate and protein snack, 30 to 60 minutes prior to exercise, such as like 50 grams of carbohydrate or 5 to 10 grams of protein. Okay, that can increase carb availability towards the end of an intense exercise bout. That can be helpful. So something, you know, ingested within the 30 to 60 minutes before, carb and protein, can have benefit during a prolonged exercise session. Prehydrate to begin exercise and maintain good hydration status throughout. And then nutrients such as creatine beta-alanine, HMB and other nutrients can be beneficial if they're taken prior to exercise. And I'll just highlight one study that was recently published in the Journal of the International Society of Sport Nutrition. It involves a pre-workout product, and that pre-workout product has beta-alanine, it has creatine, it has branched-chain amino acids as the main active ingredients. Plus, it has some nitric oxide precursors in the form of nitrates from beets and pomegranate. Okay, it was an 8-week study, and so those were the levels that you see, 5 grams of creatine, 3 grams of beta-alanine. This was all taken pre-workout, and then over an 8-week period, guys were trained really hard in Dr. Jacob Wilson's lab, who spoke earlier today. So both groups, there was a placebo group, and then there was the pre-workout group. Both groups experienced increases in strength, body leanness, and muscle mass, but those that received the pre-workout containing the creatine, the beta-alanine, and branch chains, they had significantly greater gains after 8 weeks. Okay? The point of this is not to highlight that particular product, but it's to highlight the idea that these nutrients taken prior to training, okay, that's a good time to take them, and it can lead to benefits in strength, size, and body leanness. All right, so this little scoreboard here, we'll look at it a few times throughout. I just highlighted some nutrients that are very popular during specific time periods in and around a training session. you can come to your own conclusions. Some of them are clearly demonstrated as efficacious, and others are, you know, still remain to be fully vetted out as to whether or not, you know, they're applicable at that time. All right, so what goes on during, and what are we thinking? Nutrients that are brought into the body during a training session, they can be brought in for energy. It could be fluid for hydration. You see a lot of people walking around with jugs during training, or hitting the water fountain or whatever. They're trying to stay hydrated or keep hydration optimal. Electrolytes become much more important during sustained longer exercise, probably lasting more than an hour and a half, during heavy sweating when electrolytes are being lost. And what I like to call pre-recovery nutrition, and that is nutrients that could be taken either just before or during, which may play a role in reducing soreness or reducing muscle damage or inflammation, something along those lines. Branched-chain amino acids taken in higher levels, maybe like 9 grams, somewhere up in that area, it seemed to reduce muscle damage. Carnitine, maybe another nutrient which may reduce muscle soreness. So what's interesting during this period of time is muscle that's being trained, the doors open up, basically. Transporters come to the surface of muscle cells, the transporters that are there. Nutrients are just flowing in and out. This is a fantastic time for nutrients to enter muscle cells. This is why some of the nutrients that may be taken immediately before or during training, you know, they have a better shot at getting into muscle. Okay, the blood is flowing there, vessels are dilating, blood is moving into trained muscle, and then the muscle cells are more receptive to bringing nutrients in. So you can see the traffic that occurs during training. All right, this is an interesting slide. This is maximal cycling at 100 revolutions per minute, just all out, just going at it, and doing three bouts separated by 4 minutes. And what is the fuel used during the three bouts? Okay, this could be applied perhaps to, even though it's cycling, this could be applied to like sprinting, ice hockey, soccer, just intermittent high intensity separated by periods of rest in between. But what's important here is that you see from one bout to another, glycogen is the primary fuel during that first bout. And you use that first bout as sort of the 100% or the benchmark. During the second bout, the total amount of work that's done during that bout decreases. Okay? This isn't too, dissimilar from doing multiple sets in the gym, that you do less reps over time. You fatigue earlier. But what's interesting is, when you look at this, the contribution made by aerobic metabolism is about the same from the first bout to the second. Creatine phosphate is regenerated in between the bouts, so it makes the same contribution again. But glycogen, the contribution made by glycogen goes down. So the glycogen potential is decreased during the second bout and then decreased again during the third bout. Okay? So how important is muscle glycogen to maximal efforts in the gym, maximal efforts during sprint activity, sort of intermittent sprint activity? It's very important. And again, going back to a previous slide, starting with more glycogen will allow you to perform even higher, you know, in these versus starting out with very low glycogen stores. All right, so let's take a look at that. That was three sort of separated sprint bouts. If you look at three cycling bouts at different intensities, sort of a nice casual ride, a more intense ride, and then a much higher higher intensity ride that can't be sustained for very long. But this is what the fuel contributions are after 30 minutes. So at the lowest intensity, okay, if you wanted to equate this to maybe walking, it would be, you know, walking, jogging, running. So just think about that along those lines. And what I did was I put the brackets around around the fat sources during that time. So during walking, you go, wow, you know, I'm burning a very high percentage of fat while I'm walking. And then you go to the jog, and you're like, I'm burning more calories. But when I look at my combined fat, when I look at my combined fat contribution, which is the red bar and the blue bar, that's the fat that's coming from the blood, from adipose tissue, and the fat that's coming from within the muscle cells themselves. My fat contribution is actually increased on a quantity level, okay, absolute quantity. Okay, percentage of fat utilization actually goes down, but the amount of fat that you burn during that time actually increases. And then in the third one, at a much higher intensity, you see that the fat contribution goes down even further. Muscle becomes much more reliant on carbohydrate. Okay, it requires less oxygen to burn carb than fat. And the contribution that fat makes is much smaller, okay, even though the total work performed is greater. So at what intensity is the most amount of fat utilized? That's sort of that moderate intensity. All right, so the provision of carbohydrate, such as in a sport drink during sustained exercise, okay, drinking carbohydrate fluid, electrolyte kind of beverage throughout after a couple of hours. So you see at the 2 and 2.5 hour point, without any supplemented level, without any sport drink, fatigue can occur. Okay, where the sport drink really comes in, it really assists late in that activity. When muscle glycogen stores are waning, okay, it provides carbohydrate in the blood, which helps nourish the muscle and allows it to perform longer. Okay, so sport drink is important as a late carbohydrate source. Intermittent athletes such as soccer and football, sport drink can help maintain glycogen stores longer. And then there was a question earlier about waxy maize starch in reference to other types of carbohydrate. Because if you're going to provide carbohydrate either immediately before or during training, it's important to pick the right one. Okay, some work faster, some work slower. Some will bloat the stomach, some will not. So you got to be careful in what you choose depending on what you intend it to do. So this is a real nice table. You can kind of look at it at your leisure, but it'll kind of define different types of carbohydrates based on molecular size, how fast they're digested, whether they're digested slow or fast or very fast, what their glycemic effect is. It means how dramatic will they raise blood glucose levels. That can be really important either immediately before or immediately after training when you're trying to recover glycogen stores, okay, and the insulin effect as well. All right, so waxy maize starch was mentioned earlier, so I'll just kind of work my way across. It's like three from the bottom. Very large molecule. It's actually slow digesting, okay, a molecule, so it has a generally low glycemic effect. There's a couple of versions of enzymatically modified starches now that that are sort of specialized, but the classic waxy maize starch, a lot of the research that was done on it going back 5-7 years was actually done to see if it could be used with people who are diabetic or people that are struggling with blood glucose control. Okay, maltodextrin, I like to point that one out because a lot of times people refer to it as just kind of a bulking agent, that a cheap carb or whatever, but actually, functionally, it's a good carbohydrate. If you look at its properties, it's a medium-sized carbohydrate. It's digested pretty fast. And it has a good glycemic effect. That means it gets into the blood quickly. That can aid during exercise, and it can also aid after exercise when you're recovering glycogen stores. Okay? So that's just my shout-out to maltodextrin because I think a lot of times it gets a bad rap because it is used sometimes by some companies as sort of a bulking agent, okay, just to add mass to a serving size. But if you're using it as a carbohydrate, it's a pretty good carbohydrate. Okay, so here are just some of the things that we kind of talked about and a couple of other ones that you can look at as intra-workout nutrients. And then just a couple of key points. Carb availability during exercise and muscle glycogen levels are major determinants of endurance and extended intermittent performance. Prolonged endurance exercise, greater than 60 to 90 minutes of moderate to high intensity exercise will deplete muscle carbohydrate stores. That's the gas tank. During sustained exercise, regular consumption of a carb and electrolyte solution, a good, an average 6 to 8% carbohydrate, which is typical for most sport drinks. That means 6 to 8 grams of carbohydrate per 100 milliliters of fluid. Should be consumed every 15 to 20 minutes to sustain blood glucose. And then looking more specifically at the carbohydrate source, glucose, sucrose, specialized fast digesting, low bloating starches can support sustained performance. Fructose is not a good choice as an individual carbohydrate. It is one half of sucrose. So if you're consuming, something that contains like a high fructose corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup tends to be more than 60% fructose by weight, or just sucrose, table sugar. That fructose just isn't brought into the body quickly, and it's not your best choice for delivering fast carbohydrate during exercise. A couple of other points, ingesting carbohydrate alone or in combination with protein during resistance exercise increases muscle glycogen stores, offsets muscle damage, and facilitates greater training adaptations after acute and prolonged periods of resistance training. With regard to hydration and staying hydrated, sweat rates, you can track sweat rates. Weigh yourself before and after. Your weight difference before and after, by and large, is sweat. So you can equate that to water. And if you drink the equivalent of what you sweat, okay, and factor out P, you've got a pretty good indicator of how much water your body lost and the impact that, then you can actually equate it to what some percentage levels of body weight decrease are related to decreased performance. Just get an idea of that, and then also form a strategy to maintain hydration during exercise, particularly if you sweat. Okay, if you're not a sweater during exercise, then the focus on hydration isn't that great. Just go into a workout in good hydration status. Supplementing branched-chain amino acids before and during training can aid in recovery and help prime post-exercise muscle protein synthesis. Carnitine can support reduced delayed onset muscle soreness. Taurine has been noted potentially to support cognitive benefit. And then, as mentioned earlier, one of the first thoughts is post-exercise. So now let's transition into post-exercise or recovery nutrition. Muscle protein synthesis, MPS, is where we target a lot of the action when it comes to recovery, but we can't forget carbohydrate and recovery of muscle glycogen stores as well and getting that going quickly, especially for some sports where people will do it more than once a day or train hard and then come back and train hard the next day using those same muscle groups. Okay, so key pathways include the mTOR pathway, which is probably the most recognized right now, and then AMPK, and then MAPK, so forth and so on. So those are the pathways that signal muscle protein synthesis. And when Dr. Willoughby is up, he'll probably spend a little bit of time talking about that as well. Very, very fascinating. But also not to forget the recovery of energy stores, glycogen that has been depleted. For somebody that just goes into the gym and they'll do 3 sets per body part or even 6 sets per body part, they're really not going to exhaust their muscle glycogen. The emphasis on, you know, hitting carbohydrate hard after training, you know, big levels, big doses, not as important for somebody that goes in and trains, you know, multiple sets per body part and training it hard. And, you know, then it's a little bit more important. And then endurance athletes that are going to train those same areas, you know, almost every day, such as cyclists or runners or so forth. A lot of times we like to focus on protein. It's the most obvious when it comes to muscle. Muscle is about 20 to 22% protein by wet weight. And then when you wring all the water out of muscle, you end up with greater than 80% of the mass of dry muscle is actually protein, which is why that's why we're focused. And then the only other point that I'll make, the second to last bullet there, protein turnover is an algebraic sum. Here you actually get to use algebra in your adult life, but basically muscle protein synthesis, muscle protein breakdown, sort of the relationship between the two, the plus and the minus, gives you the net, and you always want the net to be positive. Long-term positives equal bigger, stronger, faster, so forth. So if you just kind of want to lay it out schematically, resistance exercise has maybe 3 primary prongs as to what happens, okay? You got muscle contraction, you got hormonal modifications, and then you get immunological actions as well. This sets in play a couple of different things. These are the things that lead to muscle growth. Muscle fiber signaling, pathways and systems, these get stoked up. You also get satellite cell, which are cells that are kind of hanging out in muscle tissue. They will begin to change and then adhere to muscle cells, making them bigger, but doing something really special when they do that. I'll talk about that in the next slide. Muscle protein synthesis increases, muscle protein breakdown decreases, and you see over on the left side the role of nutrition and how nutrition will amplify these. It'll amplify muscle protein synthesis, it will decrease muscle protein breakdown, and certain nutrients can aid in the fusing of satellite cells with myofibers, with muscle cells. All this contributes to muscle growth over time. So here's a picture here. You can see the satellite cells over on the right-hand side. The beauty of them is that they bring in mitochondria that can aid in, that increases the energy potential within the cells, the ability to generate ATP within the cells. So as muscle cells are cranking out new proteins and building more of the contractile machinery, you also get the fusing of satellite cells, which can aid by delivering some of the metabolic machinery as well that will help drive a bigger muscle unit. All right, so let's talk about protein timing with regard to pre and post. This was a study that was done by Paul Cribb a few years ago, and what they did was they provided a meal pre and post. And the composition of that meal is 32 grams of protein, 34 grams of carbohydrate, and 5.6 grams of creatine. They gave it pre and post. And then to another group, they took the same meals, but they did it in the morning and in the evening. So what you're looking at is the importance or the delivery of the nutrition pre and post versus evening and morning, and seeing if there were any benefits from the training that both groups received. And then on the left-hand side, you can see that both groups improved in, made some headway in lean body mass, but the group that received the meals pre and post had a significantly higher lean body mass gain. And then body fat percentage reduction was greater in the pre and post group as well. Moving on to the next, some of the others, greater increases in strength in the pre and post group, and then looking more specific at the muscle cells themselves, the cross-sectional area where you're looking at muscle cells, like you're looking down the barrel of a shotgun, the diameter actually increased greater in the pre-post group. So muscle cells, that's a measure of hypertrophy. They just got bigger. than the group that received the same meals in the evening and in the morning. All right. So just looking at that, and you're saying, wow, you know, so protein, carbohydrate, pre and post, you know, really, really important. About 10 years ago, Rasmussen and Phillips kind of wrote a review article on this, and looking at it, pre-resistance exercise and 3 hours post-resistance exercise, giving them nothing. So no carbohydrate, no amino acids, 6 grams of oral amino acids, just giving them nothing. They trained. And then looking at it before and then looking at it after. There we go. So muscle protein synthesis here, pre, and here, you can see that it remains lower than muscle protein breakdown in both of those situations. So either right before or right after training, 3 hours after training, muscle protein breakdown is greater than synthesis. Okay, going back to your algebra, that's a negative. That's not where you want to be. And then if they gave them the 6 grams of oral essential amino acids before resistance exercise, you see you get the reverse. And then 3 hours after, you get an even more significant difference between them 3 hours afterwards. So the key takeaway here is that 6 grams of oral essential amino acids, you can make an extrapolation out to intact protein with that, but essential amino acids seem to be really, really important for muscle protein synthesis, either without exercise or after exercise, okay, as shown in these two graphs here. Okay, so protein and carbohydrate at this point 10 years ago was both viewed as really kind of important in different ways, but both maybe carbohydrate was kind of supporting the protein. But then the question really kind of was, let's filter it down even further. And is carbohydrate really doing anything, or is protein doing the workload when it comes to muscle protein synthesis? And so this study was done where they did 25 grams of whey immediately after resistance exercise. And then they did 25 grams of whey plus 50 grams of carbohydrate. So you get whey plus carbohydrate versus protein alone. So here you find an insulin effect is greater with the added carbohydrate versus just a tiny little, you know, a much smaller increase in insulin with the whey. And then here, this is the level of essential amino acids. You see that it goes a little bit higher with the protein by itself than it does with the protein with the carbohydrate. Okay, but when it comes down to muscle protein synthesis, okay, what you find is you get maximal stimulus with the protein and the protein plus carbohydrate. There's no further benefit. This is without exercise. And then with exercise, there's no benefit either. So the point is, protein by itself led to maximal muscle protein synthesis. Adding carbohydrate does not take this little bar graph up higher. It's the same. There's no difference between the two. So the point is, the carbohydrate isn't that important when it comes to muscle protein synthesis. Okay, there's some research suggested that it has a good effect in sort of minimizing muscle protein breakdown, and it may act on that side of the net equation, but when it comes to muscle protein synthesis side, it seems to be protein primarily. So that helps us tease out the importance of carbohydrate for muscle protein synthesis, but not to forget the role of carbohydrate in recovering glycogen stores and some other benefits as well. All right, so next question is, so if it's protein, 25 grams according to that study, do you do it all at once, or is it okay for me just to sort of nibble on protein over time? And that's what this study looked at, okay? Immediately after resistance exercise, either 25 grams of whey or 25 grams of whey given over 10 small 2.5 gram doses every 20 minutes. So what is that? 10 divided by 20. So you're out a few hours, and you're getting 2.5 grams of the protein every 20 minutes. And they referred to this as sort of pulsing the protein. So what's the difference between the two? Well, when you look at the pathways mTOR and AKT, you actually find that the bolus, giving it all at once, led to greater increases in the signaling pathways. okay, for the first couple of hours. And then you find just significant increases in total muscle protein synthesis for the first few hours when you give just 25 grams all at once, right up front, versus sort of breaking it into 2.5 gram increments. Okay? So protein's more important than protein is important, and carbohydrate isn't that important for muscle protein synthesis, and getting it as more of a bolus versus stretching it out over time. Okay? Well, that led to additional questions. And is it just protein in general, or maybe is it specific amino acids that you really need to get to muscle to maximize muscle protein or to optimize muscle protein synthesis? Well, let's take a look at it. Protein synthesis, if you're just fasting, let's go ahead and draw this line right here. Whole protein takes it up, and let's say it doubles it. This is arbitrary units, but let's just say it doubles it. Okay? If you give them essential amino acids, it takes it up to the level that you find with whole protein. So it's the essential amino acids that seem to be most important when it comes to maximizing muscle protein synthesis. But which ones? Well, let's validate that, and let's look at non-essential amino acids. Okay? Takes it, you know, doesn't really have a big impact on muscle protein synthesis, not like the essential amino acids did. But if you take the essential amino acids and you pull out leucine, then you get a muscle protein synthesis level that's on par with the non-essential amino acids. So it does seem like there might be a special essential amino acid, and that's the branch chain amino acid leucine. So leucine seems to be important. Some people refer to it as a trigger, maybe a way to augment the already elevated muscle protein synthesis. Maybe it's the, you know, while all the other amino acids are delivering building blocks, leucine may play an additional role in that it is helping to stimulate higher levels of muscle protein synthesis above and beyond what the resistance training does on its own. All right, so let's take a look at, let's validate that, or let's look at one kind of exercise and see if there's a way to sort of lend some support to that. During endurance exercise, the participants either ingested 10 grams of essential amino acids, which delivered 1.87 grams of leucine, so under 2 grams of leucine, and then 10 grams of essential amino acids where the leucine was increased. So they brought down the other essential amino acids, and they brought leucine up to a level of 3.5. So both got 10 grams of essential amino acids, but at this point, this trial, they got more leucine. So the amino acid delivery was the same. The only difference was that leucine was at a higher level at one point. And what they kind of determined in this study was that the added leucine to the essential amino acids increased the signaling pathways more than just the essential amino acids by themselves. This, again, kind of lends some support to the idea that leucine may have an additional signaling kind of role within muscle cells themselves. Okay, it's really kind of interesting, and there's, you know, I'll leave that for now. But it kind of brings up the idea of protein quality and muscle protein synthesis. And is protein? Should you be targeting specific amino acids as a component of that protein? And should you be, kind of weeding out other maybe amino acids that may not be that important? And I make that point because there are some amino acids that you find in some products, protein-based products, that probably aren't doing any good when they're added. Okay, sometimes you see sort of amino blends and so forth in protein products, and it includes taurine or glycine, okay, or the non-amino acid, the amino acid derivative creatine. Okay, all of these will contribute to the total nitrogen claim based on testing methodologies, but they're probably not doing you any good with regard to building muscle mass outside of creatine, which does its own thing. But it's not; they're not going to be. So let's take a look at taurine real fast. Is taurine a building block for protein synthesis in the human body? It's not. It's an amino acid that is not used by the body as a building block for protein. It's got other roles in the body. I'm not saying it's completely null and void nutrient. It does other things. But if it's part of a protein supplement, You got to ask what it's in there for. Okay, glycine. It's a non-essential amino acid based on some of the previous slides. How important are the non-essential amino acids to stimulating muscle protein synthesis above the exercise stimulus? Doesn't seem to be very important. Why would you target the addition of glycine as an amino acid in a protein product? Okay, so taurine, not used as a building block for muscle protein synthesis. Glycine, a non-essential amino acid, easily converted to blood glucose in the liver. A lot of it doesn't even make it past the liver after absorption. Creatine tests out as protein in products because it's a nitrogen contributor. In fact, it has twice the level of nitrogen. It's 32% nitrogen versus protein in general, which is around 16%. Okay, so it'll test out as protein based on current methods used by laboratories. It's cheap. It's a cheap ingredient. It's a way that companies will inflate protein claims on their label without actually adding quality protein. Same with taurine, same with glycine. When you look at labels, you just gotta say, well, what's it in there for? Or if it's in there, are they teasing it out? Are they teasing it out? And is there really, let's say there's 25 grams on the label, is there really 25 grams of whey or whatever it is? And then are they saying plus 2 grams of creatine? Or plus, you know, is it added to instead of being counted as? Because if I'm buying a protein product and it's got glycine and taurine in there at gram levels, then I know that I'm not getting my money's worth. All right, so different proteins can have different kind of speed to absorption. We know that whey is fast. I like to talk about whey and casein because, it's just so interesting. The milk proteins are really fascinating, especially when you look at them in comparison to human milk. They're kind of reverse in their quantities. Milk is made up, milk proteins are about 80% casein and about 20% whey. Human milk is somewhere around 60-40 whey to casein. So they're almost kind of reversed. It kind of gives you an idea of some of the differences between maybe cows and people. But whey as a protein is fast digesting, fast absorbing, which is why it's so popular immediately before or immediately after training. And then casein as a protein is digested much more slowly. Okay, you can watch amino acids enter the bloodstream. They're entering the bloodstream much slower than you will see with whey. And then when you use blended proteins, whether it's egg or soy or rice or pea or whatever it is, you tend to see a curve which is somewhere in the middle of those guys. So you can use different proteins which will deliver amino acids at different rates. There's a lot of questions around, is whey better than casein? Is it better than soy? A lot of times it's kind of milk proteins versus soy protein or whatever. All I can tell you is they're different. They're different. So if you understand the differences, either one can be applied. So let's just kind of talk about, you know, how they may be a little bit different. And some of this comes out in a study that was done by Tang et al. Just a couple of years ago where they looked at whey hydrolysates. Casein and soy protein, they were all sort of standardized, so each one delivered 10 grams of essential amino acids. So they kind of matched them up for essential amino acids, but they were different in leucine, and I'll talk about that in just a second. But when they looked at it, when you looked at it here, whey amino acids entered the bloodstream quicker than with soy and casein. Okay, so the insulin response was higher for whey. And then when you're looking at muscle protein synthesis, whey versus rest versus post-exercise, if you give the whey immediately after, it's higher than the other ones, okay, soy and casein. And this is measured for the first 3 hours. So they took a sample of the muscle after 3 hours of giving, you know, post-exercise and giving the protein, and you get a different response. So in my view, this is very suggestive that whey is faster digesting, faster absorbing, delivering more amino acids to muscle more quickly, and maybe getting to that leucine threshold level more quickly than either soy or casein. One interesting thing, when this paper does a really nice job in that they give you the amino acid levels. And one of the major differences between the whey and the whey and the soy was the soy, they actually gave a little bit more soy. It was just like a gram extra or a little bit less to balance out the essential amino acids. But even when they balanced out the essential amino acids, the leucine content was still about a half a gram, half a gram lower. So it was underneath 2, I think it was like 1.8 grams in the soy. So my suggestion would be that if somebody is using soy versus whey, my suggestion would be that you probably just want to take more of it. Okay, so 25 grams of whey, maybe 30 grams of soy. Just take more of it. All right, so a couple of points around post-exercise. Within the first 30 minutes, ample consumption of carbohydrate and a daily consumption of 8 to 10 grams has been shown to maximally stimulate muscle glycogen resynthesis. Again, really, really important for endurance athletes who are training every day, okay, cyclists, runners, so forth. Not as important, I would say, for, you know, bodybuilders and so forth. What I always recommend for bodybuilders people that, you know, fitness enthusiasts and so forth, I have them take, you know, their energy carbohydrates, you know, the ones that are primarily fuel-based, so whether it's breads or pastas, you know, if they're really including those in their diet, I always recommend them first thing in the morning and immediately after training, and then taper them out after that. So very important for endurance athletes, intermittent athletes, and some weight trainers. You know, really a lot of it depends on how hard they train for how long and how quickly their next training session is coming. Adding protein and carbohydrate, a ratio of about 3 to 1, has been shown to stimulate glycogen resynthesis very well. Ingestion of greater than 20 to 25 grams of high quality protein or 6 to 20 grams of essential amino acids, different research, within 3 hours after exercise bout or immediately within 3 hours after an exercise bout or immediately before exercise has been shown to strongly stimulate muscle protein synthesis. Milk protein sources such as whey and casein exhibit different kinetic digestion patterns and may subsequently differ in their support of training adaptation. I listed out just a couple of key post-workout nutrients that are kind of interesting. And then going into an area that I think is really kind of interesting, and we'll hear more about it, sleep. Okay, nighttime nutrition, nocturnal nutrition. You know, a lot of times it's sort of the forgotten 8 hours, okay, if you're still getting 8 hours. But I like to think of it this way as well. Even if you're asleep for 8 hours, and if you remember, Miss Oprah Winfrey said, don't eat after 7, you know, and a lot of people follow that rule, you know, and there's a lot of athletes and a lot of weight trainers and so forth that will follow that rule. They will not eat into the evening. After dinner, they're done, and they won't eat. So when you think about sleep, and you're like, okay, I go to bed around 10, I get up around 6. But if you don't eat for a couple of hours before, and then you wake up and you're slow to get, I mean, that period of time is really like 10, 11 hours of missed nutrition. Nutrients that could potentially have a positive effect on muscle tissue, especially for somebody who's training. What's interesting is protein is digested the same while you sleep as it does when you're awake. It's absorbed the same. It has the same impact on muscle protein synthesis and minimizing muscle protein breakdown. So this has led to the whole idea that if you consume protein immediately before bed, okay, that you can, there's potential benefit there, that you can stimulate some muscle protein synthesis while you sleep. Okay, that's what a great benefit. You don't even have to work for it. It's just happening while you sleep. Okay, even though you sleep, your muscle doesn't sleep is a good way to think about it. All right, so this is an area that you'll hear more about. A lot of people don't want to do it because they think that also sleep is a time in which they're going to burn the most fat, that they're going to become the most catabolic with adipose tissue while they sleep. You know, that you know, they're going to be burning a lot of fat. It's just rolling out of fat tissue. So the key, I think, to a lot of nighttime nutrition is how do you get the benefits with muscle protein synthesis, minimizing maybe the insulin effect, and still allowing for lipolysis or breakdown of fat while you sleep. So the benefits on muscle and the benefits on breaking down fat. What, you know, as, if we can accomplish that, then I think nighttime nutrition will just explode. All right, science of split dosing, timing, so forth. I think this is an area that also it will grow over the years to come. You see a lot more split dosing of creatine now. You see split dosing of beta-alanine for practical purposes, but there may be some other benefits as well. Branched-chain amino acids throughout the day. Leucine, okay, a lot of people will take 2 grams of leucine throughout the day or the equivalent from branched-chain amino acids, whether it's 2-1-1 or whatever. Still targeting like 2 grams of leucine at periods throughout the day. Omega-3 fatty acids taken with meals. To utilize the whole chylomicron fat absorption thing, probably a good idea to split that up over a couple of meals over the course of the day as well. It's something that, you know, a lot of us can't do well, you know, compliance well habitually, just because, you know, you don't want to knock down a lot of pills or whatever, but there, you know, the years to come will help us better understand, you know, whether or not split dosing has additional benefit over just kind of like bolus supplementation. Like I'm going to take all my fish oil in the morning. I'm going to take all my creatine with one meal. Should I take 2.5 grams before I train, 2.5 grams later in the day? I don't know. That's what we'll have to try to figure out, and whether the benefits outweigh the impact on lifestyle. All right, so that's all I have for you. And before I turn it over to the big guy, there's time for a few questions. And you didn't have to get all dressed up to come to the... Shoot.
As far as the soybean seed potatoes, do you know what, like, the grill with peach protein, like, most protein synthesis look like? So it's like total area under the curve, similar to the one.
Now, that's a guy that you talked to right there. So the area under the curve for muscle protein synthesis, if you extend it out, you're talking about gram level for gram level, like 25 grams versus 25 grams? Or, so I'll speak, and then Dr. Willoughby can talk to it as well. You know, there has been, you know, when it just goes gram for gram like that, sometimes whey protein results in a stronger muscle protein synthesis measurement. So that's what I was kind of saying, that there may be some fundamental differences in amino acid composition that may dictate that you kind of, if you standardize those, so if you get a little bit more soy, then your muscle protein synthesis amount may be the same, 25 grams of whey, maybe 30 grams of soy. You may get there where they're exactly the same, but not every study has shown that. And then there's been some studies that, you know, for blended soy products where it's blended with whey and maybe, you know, MPI and casein or whatever, you know, you get some nice muscle protein synthesis measures. Dr. Willoughby, do you want to add anything to that? So whey versus soy, right? Was that the...
I was whey, soy, and
Yeah.
You know, I would say that if you're going to compare all three of those, then you're going to find your milk-based protein is going to be more superior to soy. But, you know, just like Dr. Antonio mentioned earlier, the lamin is, you know, don't discount soy. The soy is still a very good protein source. You know, you may not have the same content relative to amino acids. And, you know, the GI levels in the thiamine are really, really, really low. Nevertheless, it's, you know, it's not something that should be discounted. And also you get the additional benefit of the antioxidant effects go along with soy as well. It can help minimize muscle protein breakdown while, you know, spiking protein synthesis as well. Relative to the contribution, you know, synthesis area and everything, it's not going to be, it's going to be a bit inferior to milk-based proteins. And that's on a gram-to-gram basis also.
All right. Perfect segue into Dr. Willoughby, who will be the last
speaker.
Yeah, sure.
How do you see, like, competition time of the day or, like, training time of the day and, like, the diurnal cycle kind of affecting your pre- and post-workout kind of timing?
Competition or training during the day?
Yeah. Like morning or nighttime training or competition and, like, that diurnal cycle, how does that affect maybe what your prescription for pre- and post-workout supplementation is?
So if you're training or competing first thing in the morning?
Yeah.
And sadly, you know, a lot of athletes will train first thing in the morning, or, you know, runners will get up, especially in the middle of the summer, and they'll train at 6 o'clock in the morning before it gets too hot or whatever it is. And they will like, overlook. They'll overlook that opportunity first thing in the morning, you know, to get some, like, even a whey protein isolate and some carbohydrate is going to go a long way for, you know, sort of dealing with sort of the metabolic scenario that's happening while you sleep, as well as giving you a little bit of a primer for the training that you're going to do. So, you know, it's the hardest thing that I think, and, you know, Dr. Antonio can jump in on this too, is to get swimmers to eat before they get in the pool at 6 a.m., or to get runners to do something beyond, like, coffee before they go out and they do a 10-miler at 6 o'clock in the morning or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, you're dead on in that you really, a lot of people overlook it, but first thing in the morning you got two factors versus what you got going on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You're coming out of the night and you're trying to reverse what's happening from a catabolic perspective in muscle, and then at the same time you're also, you know, faced with priming yourself as well as rehydrating after just losing moisture throughout the night as well, you know, whether it's through the skin or through the breath. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people overlook it, but it's huge first thing in the morning.
Have you seen any changes that happen for competition or training at night, like in the evening time? And maybe, how does that affect maybe what you prescribed earlier in the day?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting. Those slides that I built, those are actually sliders. And, you know, I used to use those with athletes and move around the training, and sometimes you drop in two or three if they're multi-sport athletes, like triathletes. But, yeah, I mean, you know, regardless of where your training is throughout the day, the same principles apply. But if you're training at night, which a lot of people do after they're done work, you know, their dinner actually becomes their pre-workout meal. And then they still should, depending on when that dinner falls and when the training falls, you know, they still should be thinking, should I be nourishing? Should I be, you know, doing something after I train but before bed? And the answer is probably yes. So, you know, it just, you know, kind of where it falls over the course of the day makes you think differently as to whether you label breakfast as your pre-workout meal, or lunch as it, or dinner as it, and what your post-workout meal is. A lot of times your post-workout meal is dinner, you know, or lunch if you train at 10 in the morning. But if you train at 8 o'clock at night, a lot of hockey players play at night, you know, club sports, you know, they train after school, you know, and sadly, or even NFL, you know, professional athletes, a lot of times their games are at night. You know, beyond chicken wings and beer for a lot of college, I mean, they're not really heavily focused on, you know, recovery, adaptation. Yeah. It's a challenge. Yeah, I'm.
I mean, I would say just from a pragmatic standpoint, treat morning and evening training the same in terms of the nutrient recommendations. The only drawback of nighttime training is you can't load up on caffeine.
Right. And that's a good point.
That's what I would do.
Unless you're in college and you're going out afterwards, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that would be the only drawback. You can't just accept college. That's great for morning training.
Right. You good to go, big guy?
I think so.